Chapter 14. An Early Arrival. John? Through the fog of sleep, I gradually registered my name being called. It was Jenny. She was shaking me. John, I think the baby might be coming. I propped myself up on an elbow and rubbed my eyes. Jenny was lying on her side, knees pulled to her chest. The baby what? I'm having bad cramps, she said. I've been lying here timing them. We need to call Dr. Sherman. I was wide awake now. Jenny was 21 weeks into the pregnancy, barely halfway through the 40-week gestation period. Among her motherhood books was a collection of high-definition in vitro photographs showing a fetus at each week of development. At 21 weeks, a fetus can fit in the palm of a hand. It weighs less than a pound. Its eyes are fused shut, its fingers like fragile little twigs, its lungs not yet developed enough to distill oxygen from air. At 21 weeks, a baby is barely viable. The chance of surviving outside the womb is small, and the chance of surviving without serious long-term health problems, smaller yet. It's probably nothing, I said, but I could feel my heart pounding as I speed-dialed the OBGYN answering service. 2 minutes later, Dr. Sherman called back, sounding groggy himself. It might just be gas, but we better have a look. He told me to get Jenny to the hospital immediately. Sorry, Mar, I told him as I led him out to the garage, grave disappointment on his face. You've got to hold down the fort. I scooped Patrick out of his crib, buckled him into his car seat without waking him, and into the night we went. At St. Mary's Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, the nurses quickly went to work. They got Jenny into a hospital gown and hooked her to a monitor that measured contractions and the baby's heartbeat. Sure enough, Jenny was having a contraction every 6 minutes. "Your baby wants to come out," one of the nurses said. "We're going to do everything we can to make sure he doesn't just yet." Dr. Sherman ordered an intravenous saline drip and an injection of the labor inhibitor Brethine. The contractions leveled out, but less than 2 hours later, they were back again. For the next 12 days, Jenny remained hospitalized. Poor Marley's status dropped precipitously from second fiddle to not even in the orchestra. Even as I ignored him, he faithfully followed me as I careened through the house with Patrick in one arm, vacuuming or toting laundry or fixing a meal with the other. One night, after I finally got Patrick to sleep, I fell back on the couch exhausted. Marley pranced over and dropped his rope tug toy in my lap and looked up at me with those giant brown eyes of his. "Sorry, pal, not tonight." He crinkled his brow and cocked his head. His mistress was mysteriously absent, his master no fun, and nothing the same. He let out a little whine, and I could see he was trying to figure it out. Life wasn't completely bleak for Marley. On the bright side, I had quickly reverted to my pre-marriage, read slovenly, lifestyle. I suspended the Married Couple Domesticity Act and proclaimed the once-banished bachelor rules to be the law of the land. While Jenny was in the hospital, shirts would be worn twice, even three times, barring obvious mustard stains, between washes. Milk could be drunk directly from the carton, and toilet seats would remain in the upright position unless being sat on. Much to Marley's delight, I instituted a 24/7 open-door policy for the bathroom. From there, it only made sense to let him start drinking from the bathtub tap. Now that the seat-up policy was firmly in place, I needed to offer Marley a viable alternative to that attractive porcelain pool. I got into the habit of turning the bathtub faucet on at a trickle while I was in the bathroom so Marley could lap up some cool fresh water. The dog could not have been more thrilled had I built him an exact replica of Splash Mountain. He would twist his head up under the faucet and lap away, tail banging the sink behind him. I soon realized I had created a bathtub monster. Pretty soon, Marley began going into the bathroom alone without me, and standing there, staring forlornly at the faucet, licking at it for any lingering drop, flicking the drain knob with his nose until I couldn't stand it any longer and would come in and turn it on for him. The next step on our descent into barbarity came when I was showering. I'd be lathering up, and without warning, his big tawny head would pop in, and he'd begin lapping at the shower spray. "Just don't tell Mom." I tried to fool Jenny into thinking I had everything effortlessly under control. "Oh, we're totally fine." Turning to Patrick, "Aren't we, partner?" To which he would give his standard reply, "Da, da," and then pointing at the ceiling fan, "Fan." She knew better. One day when I arrived with Patrick for our daily visit, she stared at us in disbelief. "What in God's name did you do to him?" "What do you mean? He's great. You're great, aren't you?" "Da, da, fan." "His outfit. How on earth?" Only then did I see. Something was amiss with Patrick's onesie. His chubby thighs were squeezed into the armholes, which were so tight they must have been cutting off his circulation. The collared neck hung between his legs like an udder. Up top, Patrick's head stuck out through the unsnapped crotch, and his arms were lost somewhere in the billowing pant legs. It was quite a look. "You goof! You've got it on him upside down!" "That's your opinion," I said. But the game was up. Jenny began working the phone from her hospital bed, and a couple of days later, my sweet dear Aunt Anita, a retired nurse who had come to America from Ireland as a teenager and now lived across the state from us, magically appeared, suitcase in hand, and cheerfully went about restoring order. The bachelor rules were history. When her doctors finally let Jenny come home, it was with the strictest of orders. If she wanted to deliver a healthy baby, she was to remain in bed as still as possible. The only time she was allowed on her feet was to go to the bathroom. Complete bed rest, no cheating, for the next 12 weeks. A hospital technician came to our home and attached a small battery-powered pump to Jenny's leg that delivered a continuous trickle of labor-inhibiting drugs into her bloodstream. Jenny was trying to keep her spirits up, but the boredom, the tedium, the hourly uncertainty about the health of her unborn child were conspiring to drag her down. Worst of all, she was a mother with a 15-month-old son whom she was not allowed to lift, feed, or scoop up and kiss. I would drop him on top of her on the bed, where he would pull her hair and stick his fingers into her mouth. He'd point to the whirling paddles above the bed and say, "Mama, fan." It made her smile, but it wasn't the same. She was slowly going stir-crazy. Her constant companion through it all, of course, was Marley. He set up camp on the floor beside her and held vigil, day and night. I tried to be encouraging, saying things like, "A year from now, we're going to look back on this and laugh." But I could tell part of her was slipping from me. Some days her eyes were very far away. When Jenny had a full month of bed rest still to go, Aunt Anita packed her suitcase and kissed us goodbye. She had stayed as long as she could, in fact, extending her visit several times. Once again, we were on our own. I did my best to keep the ship afloat, but the grass went uncut, the laundry unwashed, and the screen on the back porch remained unrepaired after Marley crashed through it, cartoon style, in pursuit of a squirrel. For weeks, the shredded screen door flapped in the breeze, becoming a de facto doggy door that allowed Marley to come and go as he pleased between the backyard and house during the long hours home alone with the bedridden Jenny. I could see dismay in Jenny's eyes. It took all of her self-control not to jump out of bed and whip her home back into shape. Then one day, as we approached Jenny's 35th week of pregnancy, the hospital technician arrived at her door and said, "Congratulations, girl. You've made it. You're free again." She unhooked the medicine pump, packed up the fetal monitor, and went over the doctor's written orders. Jenny was free to return to her regular lifestyle. The baby was fully viable now. "Have fun," she said. "You deserve it." Jenny tossed Patrick over her head, romped with Marley in the backyard, tore into the housework. That night we celebrated by going out for Indian food and catching a show at a local comedy club. The next day the three of us continued the festivities by having lunch at a Greek restaurant. Before the gyros ever made it to our table, however, Jenny was in full-blown labor. The cramps had begun the night before as she ate curried lamb, but she wasn't going to let a few contractions interrupt her hard-earned night on the town. By the time we got to the hospital and checked into a room, Jenny was dilated to 7 centimeters. Less than an hour later, I held our new son in my arms. "You did it," Dr. Sherman declared. "He's perfect." Connor Richard Grogan, 5 pounds and 13 ounces, was born October 10, 1993. I was so happy I barely gave a second thought to the cruel irony that for this pregnancy we had raided one of the luxury suites but had hardly a moment to enjoy it. If the delivery had been any quicker, Jenny would have given birth in the parking lot of the Texaco station. I hadn't even had time to stretch out on the dad couch. Considering what we had been through to bring him safely into this world, we thought the birth of our son was big news, but not so big that the local news media would turn out for it. Below our window, though, a crush of television news trucks gathered in the parking lot, their satellite dishes poking into the sky. I could see reporters with microphones doing their stand-ups in front of the cameras. "Hey, honey," I said, "the paparazzi have turned out for you." A nurse who was in the room attending to the baby said, "Can you believe it? Donald Trump is right down the hall." The real estate tycoon had caused quite a stir when he moved to Palm Beach several years earlier. I flicked on the TV and learned that the Donald and girlfriend Marla Maples were the proud parents of a girl appropriately named Tiffany, who was born not long after Jenny delivered Connor. "We'll have to invite them over for a play date," Jenny said. We watched from the window as the television crews swarmed in to catch the Trumps leaving the hospital with their new baby to return to their estate. Marla smiled demurely as she held her newborn for the cameras to capture. Donald waved and gave a jaunty wink. "I feel great," he told the cameras. Then they were off in a chauffeured limousine. The next morning, when our turn came to leave for home, a pleasant retiree who volunteered at the hospital guided Jenny and baby Connor through the lobby in a wheelchair and out the automatic doors into the sunshine. There were no camera crews, no satellite trucks, no sound bites, no live reports. It was just us and our senior volunteer. Not that anyone was asking, but I felt great too. Before buckling my newborn son into his car seat, I lifted him high above my head for the whole world to see, had anyone been looking, and said, "Connor Grogan, you are every bit as special as Tiffany Trump. And don't you ever forget it."